sphere in the following way. You define two functions of rho, which is going to be the radial coordinate, which is this function g of rho and this function a of rho. And finally, you define an SU2 gauge field on a two-sphere by these three components of the SU2 gauge potential. And then using all these definitions, you can write down the Molosano-Nunez solution in three lines, as it is here. So this is the string frame metric. There is this R4 component, a radial component, a two-sphere with a radius that changes according to this function g of rho, and a three-sphere, which is somewhat deformed by this gauge field, which mixes it together with the two-sphere. So this is the string frame metric, and you can verify that it has the properties that we discussed. In particular, you can see that the radius of the S2, you can see that it indeed grows linearly for large rho and goes to zero at rho equals zero. So here I've chosen the minimal value of rho to be at rho equals zero. The string coupling is given by this formula, and again, you can see that it behaves as a linear dilaton for large values of rho, and it goes to a constant e to the 2 phi 0 at the origin. And again, this e to the phi 0 is the only parameter of the solution. And finally, there is a three-form field, which is given by this formula in terms of these one-forms omega, the field, the gauge potentials A, and F, which is the field strength of this gauge potential. So this is the explicit solution. And again, given the solution, you can compute anything you want about the Molosano-Nunez, the spectrum, the confining string tension, and all these other things that we discussed. So that's one comment. Another comment, so this solution is supersymmetric, and as we said, in some limit, it gives the n equals 1 super Young-Mills theory in a limit where gravity breaks, where the gravity description breaks down, of course, as we discussed. Of course, it's also interesting to try to break supersymmetry and go to n equals 0 super Young-Mills. And as usual, one can always do that by adding some deformation that would, say, give a mass to the Gluino in this theory. And then at low energies, you would just be left with a pure Young-Mills theory. So one can discuss the deformation of this background that gives a mass to the Gluino, just like the deformations that we discussed in ADS. It's quite analogous also in this case. Now, the deformation breaks supersymmetry, and as usually when you discuss a non-supersymmetric background in string theory, you have to worry about the stability of that background. And usually if you have massless fields, then when you break supersymmetry, you have to worry that some of them may become tachyonic, and even if they don't become tachyonic, you'll generically generate a potential for them that might not have any minima, and so on. So usually it's quite difficult to construct supersymmetric non-supersymmetric stable vacua in string theory. However, here, if you just start from this background and you just deform it by adding a Gluino mass, then you're guaranteed that at least for a small deformation, you're guaranteed that this background will still be stable even after the supersymmetry breaking, because this background had a mass gap to begin with, so the whole spectrum of fluctuations around this background was massive. And then it's obvious that if you do some small deformation, then the mass spectrum can start shifting, but as long as, because all the masses squared were originally positive, then any small shift cannot destabilize this background. So it's obvious that at least for small deformations away from supersymmetry, you can deform this background and it will still be stable. And presumably, one can also do large deformations and flow to the n equals zero Young-Mills theory, although that has not been established. So this concludes the discussion of the compactification scenarios. Are there any questions about those? Okay, so our main topic today will be the third method of obtaining a theory that resembles QCD, and that's the duality cascade method. In some senses, this is the most straightforward method, so if we want to construct the n equals 1 Young-Mills theory. In our previous approaches, we started from some other theory and deformed it or compactified it to get that theory, but the most naive thing to do is just to try to build some brain configuration that really has the n equals 1 Young-Mills theory as the low energy theory on these brains, and then just take the decoupling limit and the new horizon limit, and you would get the string dual of the n equals 1 Young-Mills theory directly. So that seems like the most naive thing to do, but of course it is very complicated. The brain configurations that give us theories like the n equals 1 super Young-Mills theory tend to be very complicated brain configurations, for instance, involving D brains stretched between NS5 brains and things like that. So it's actually usually very complicated to take their near horizon limits and see which decoupled theories one gets. So what I'll describe is the simplest known way to do that, namely to build some brain configuration and take its near horizon limit and get a theory that will resemble n equals 1 super Young-Mills. And as we'll see, even in this scenario, we will not what we'll end up doing is not really just this naive thing of taking a brain configuration and taking its new horizon limit, because it's not really known how to do that in any case, but we'll end up doing something quite different, as we'll see. So that's the introduction. Now, in order to describe the brain configuration that we're interested in, I'll start by describing a slightly different brain configuration, which is the configuration of these three brains at a conifold singularity. So this theory actually does not resemble super-Young-Mills theory. It will flow to a super-conformal theory in the infrared, but we'll see that by small modifications of this theory, we will be able to get a more interesting theory. So what do I mean by these three brains at a conifold? So of course, to derive the idea of CFT correspondence, you started from these three brains in flat space and took their new horizon limit, and then you got the duality between the n=4 super-Young-Mills theory and ADS5 cross S5. Now we know that you could also compactify the type 2B string theory on some Calabi-Yau manifolds, and you can put these three brains at various points on these Calabi-Yau manifolds and try to take the new horizon limit of that. Now, of course, if these three brains are sitting just at some generic point on the Calabi-Yau manifold, then when you take the new horizon limit, because you're focusing on the region near the D3 brains, it doesn't really matter what the Calabi-Yau manifold is. Near the three brains, you don't really feel the geometry of the Calabi-Yau, and you end up just with the same new horizon limit as you did before, so you don't really gain anything. The only case where you gain anything is if these D3 brains happen to be sitting at a singular point of the Calabi-Yau, where the geometry does not locally just look like flat space. And in that case, you can actually get different things by taking this new horizon limit. And so the general case is that a Calabi-Yau can have conical singularities where the geometry locally near these singularities looks like a cone of this form. So you can write down Calabi-Yau metrics that take this form, where R is some radial coordinate, and this is just a generalized cone. So if this M5 is a 5-sphere, then this is just R6. But if this M5 is some other manifold, then this is the general description of a conical singularity. And there are various, so if M5 is what's called a Sasaki-Einstein manifold, then this really turns out to be a Calabi-Yau geometry. And in such cases, you can put a D3 brain in this manifold at R equals zero. And then if you take these three brains at R, so if you take these three brains at R equals zero and take the decoupling limit of these D3 brains, then by the same steps that you do leading to the ADS CFT correspondence, you find that the geometry becomes ADS5 cross this manifold M5 that appears here in the metric. So the generalization of the ADS CFT correspondence to this case tells you that the lower energy decoupled limit on D3 brains that are sitting at a conical singularity like this in a Calabi-Yau is dual to type 2B string theory on ADS5 cross M5. So you've seen the example that M5 was S5, but in fact, this is true in much more generality by exactly the same arguments that lead to the usual ADS CFT correspondence, so I won't repeat them. The simplest type of conical singularity that you can have in a Calabi-Yau is what's called a conifold singularity. And that singularity may be simply described by taking the Calabi-Yau to be given by the following equation in C4, just the equation that the sum of the squares of four complex coordinates is equal to zero. And this manifold has a singularity at Zi equals zero. And it's easy to see that that's a conical singularity because you have a scaling symmetry around this point. And indeed, you can write down explicitly the metric, the Calabi-Yau metric on this manifold. And it has the above form, where in this case, the five-dimensional manifold M5, which appears there, is called the T11 manifold. And it's actually a coset space given by the product of two SU2 gauge groups, two SU2 group manifolds divided by U1. And one can write down explicitly the metric on this T11 manifold, and it's given by the following formula, where I'm using coordinates psi, theta 1, phi 1, theta 2, and phi 2 to describe the manifold. And so just to see that the metric is not too complicated, of course, you probably all know that Calabi-Yau metrics for compact Calabi-Yau manifolds are very complicated and cannot usually be written down explicitly. But because this manifold is a non-compact Calabi-Yau manifold, it turns out to be possible to write down its metric explicitly, and it's not too complicated, and indeed it's just given by this formula. So the claim is that the lower energy, that type 2B string theory on ADS 5 cross this five-dimensional manifold T11 is dual to the lower energy theory of D3 bits sitting at this point ZI equals zero in this Calabi-Yau manifold. Now, of course, we'd like to know what is this field theory that sits on these D3 bands at low energies. So we'd like to put ND3 bands at the singularity and ask what is the low energy field theory on them. Usually the way that we would do this is just to study the open strings living on these D3 bands and see what are the massless modes living on them and see what's the field theory that they give. Unfortunately, in this case, we cannot really do that because this conifold is really a singularity in the Calabi-Yau manifold, and if you try to define string theory on this space, then you find that the string theory is singular near this point, and so you cannot really do perturbative string computations to compute the low energy field theory that lives on ND3 brains. So there is actually no real systematic way to figure out what this field theory is, and what Klebanov and Witten did is basically to guess what this field theory is based on various arguments and to check the consistency of their guesses by many consistency checks. So I'll describe what their guess is. So their guess is that this conformal theory living at low energies on these D3 brains comes from an SUN cross SUN gauge theory, where we have two bifundamental tower lines. So this is an n=1 supersymmetric gauge theory with this gauge group with two bifundamental fields, A1 and A2, in the bifundamental representation of SUN cross SUN and two tower fields in the anti-bifundamental representation in order to cancel the anomalies. Yes? No, it's really singular. Why not? It's singular in the sense that the string coupling becomes strong when you try to do computations near the singularity, but that doesn't mean that the lower energy theory cannot, this lower energy theory will also end up being a strongly coupled theory, as we'll see, so it's not too surprising, but this lower energy theory is still just a field theory, and one can describe it just in field theory terms. Well, what I mean by string theory is that if you try to do computations in string perturbation theory, then you find divergences. So I mean that you cannot just quantize the strings at tree level as you would usually do for D-brains in flat space and find the spectrum in that naive way. Of course, I'm not saying that if you knew how to compute things non-perturbatively, then you could get a reasonable answer. But I'm just saying that string perturbation theory breaks down. That's all I mean by singular in this case. Yes, so there are very good arguments for that, but that would take me too far afield, so I think I don't want to go into them, but yes, I mean, just in one sentence, it's understood that there are some D-brain states that become light, that wrap around some cycles in this manifold, and that if you include them also in this theory, so there are some specific non-perturbative effects, and if you include them, then the full theory does make sense. But string perturbation theory, naively, it breaks down if you try to implement it, so you cannot just use that to compute the field theory living on the D3 brains. So the guess for this field theory is this SUN cross SUN gauge theory with two bifundamental fields. Each of these SUN gauge theories has a number of flavors which is equal to 2n. So both of these gauge factors are asymptotically free, and as you go down to low energies, the gauge couplings become strong. And you've already seen in the lectures on supersymmetry that if we just had one SUN gauge group with NF equals to 2N, then that flows to a superconformal fixed point in the infrared. So you know that at least if we start from one of these gauge couplings being zero, then you know that this gauge theory flows to a superconformal fixed point in the infrared. And the claim is that, so this theory is, well, it can be labeled by the gauge couplings G1 and G2 of these two gauge groups. And you know that at least if one of them is zero, then it flows to a superconformal fixed point. And the claim is that also for arbitrary values of G1 and G2, then this theory flows to a superconformal fixed point in the infrared. And in fact, it flows to a line of fixed points. So you can compute the beta functions of these gauge couplings G1 and G2. And as you saw in the lectures about supersymmetry, you can express these beta functions in terms of the anomalous dimensions of the chiral multiplets in the theory. So you can express it in terms of the anomalous dimensions of A1, A2, B1, and B2. In this case, all these anomalous dimensions are equal to each other, and I'll label them by gamma. And that's because there is an SU2 global symmetry. So I guess I should mention that the global symmetry of this field theory, there is an SU2 cross SU2 global symmetry that rotates the two A's and the two B's. And in addition to that, there is also a U1 Baryon number symmetry that under which the A's have charge 1 and the B's have charge minus 1. And there's also a U1 R symmetry, which is the non-anomalous combination of the axial symmetry of these A's and B's together with the U1 R that rotates the phase of the Gluinos. So this is the global symmetry of this theory. And as I said, this global symmetry ensures that the two A's have the same anomalous dimension. Also, the two B's have the same anomalous dimension. And the A's and B's are just related by charge conjugation. So it's also obvious that they have the same anomalous dimension. So there's only one anomalous dimension parameter in this theory. And it's easy to see that the beta functions of both of these gauge groups are proportional to 1 plus 4 gamma. So the condition for having a fixed point of the renormalization group flow is that this should be equal to 0. So you get an equation of the form gamma, which in principle depends on these two gauge couplings, should be equal to minus 1/4. And this is just one equation in two variables. So in general, it has a class of solutions. So we saw that when G1 was 0, then this should have a solution, which is just the superconformal theory of supersymmetric QCD with NF equals 2 and C. Similarly, when G2 is 0, there is some fixed point, and the general solution to this equation will give you some fixed line in the space of parameters, such that the renormalization group flows take you to this line. Of course, this line is always strongly coupled. There's never a point where both couplings are 0, so this theory is always strongly coupled, and that's consistent because, as we said, also string theory is strongly coupled in this background, so it's not surprising that these superconformal field theories are also strongly coupled. But nevertheless, we can compute various things about them. For instance, this anomalous dimension has to be equal to minus 1/4. So this almost gives us the field theory that Klebanov and Witten described. There's just one more thing that we need to add, and it turns out that we need to add also a superpotential to this theory, which takes the following form. It's a quartic superpotential in terms of these degrees of freedom, the A's and the B's. Of course, usually in field theories, we cannot turn on quartic superpotentials because they would not be relevant. But we see that if we flow to the superconformal fixed point in the infrared, then we see that the dimensions of these scalar fields, because of these anomalous dimensions, then the superpotential is actually marginal at the fixed point. So if we first flow to this fixed point and then turn on the superpotential, then we actually can turn it on. And actually, it's easy to argue that this superpotential is exactly marginal, because if you compute the beta function of the superpotential coupling H, and I assume you've also seen this in the lectures of supersymmetry, then it's also related to the anomalous dimensions of these fields. And it's easy to see that it's also just proportional to 1 plus 4 gamma. And also, these beta functions, even after you add the superpotential, are also still proportional to 1 plus 4 gamma. So as long as you obey the single equation that the gamma, the anomalous dimension as a function of these three couplings, sorry, has to be equal to minus 1/4, then you have conformal invariance. So there's really, in the space of these two couplings, G1, G2, and H, then there's really a two-dimensional surface, which I can't really draw here, but so there is some two-dimensional surface that ends on this line in the G1, G2 plane. And the theory is conformal for every value of G1, G2, and H that solves this equation. So there's a two-dimensional space of conformal fixed points. And actually, each of these couplings can also be complexified in the usual way of supersymmetric theories. So it's really a two complex dimensional space of fixed points. But I won't go into all the details of that because it won't be important for us. So the claim is that, so we got here a two complex parameter space of superconformal field theories. And the claim is that these superconformal field theories that you get by starting from this gauge theory flowing to the infrared and adding this superpotential, the claim is that these theories are dual to type 2B string theory on this manifold ADS5 cross P11. So I won't describe all the tests of this duality, but one can perform many tests, many consistency checks to show that this duality really works, I mean, along the same lines of the usual tests of the ADS-CFT correspondence. One of the tests you can do is that you can ask what's the moduli space of this conformal field theory that you get. You expect that the moduli space of n D3 brains sitting in a conifold singularity should just be n copies of the conifold, because each of these brains can move around on the conifold, and supersymmetry ensures that there's no force between them, so you should have supersymmetric configurations corresponding to D3 brains sitting at any points in the conifold. And indeed, it's not hard to compute the moduli space of this field theory by the usual methods of supersymmetry, and to show that indeed the moduli space of this theory is given by n copies of the conifold, so the conifold to the nth power divided by the permutation symmetry, which is exactly the permutation symmetry Sn, which permutes these n copies, and that's exactly what you expect for the theory that describes n D3 brains on the conifold singularity. So again, I won't go into all the details of this mapping. What I do want to describe is how these the parameters of this conformal field theory map to the parameters of string of type 2B string theory on ADS 5 cross T11. So type 2B string theory on ADS 5 cross T11 also has turns out to have two parameters. One of these parameters is of course the deltaon, e to the phi. So you can put type 2B on this string on this manifold with any string coupling, and it still preserves conformal invariance. So that's one parameter you can change and still preserve conformal invariance. And another parameter you can turn on is that this manifold T11 turns out to have a non-contractible two-cycle. I mean, I guess here it looks like it has two cycles, but actually only one combination of them is non-trivial in the cohomology. And whenever you have a non-contractible two-cycle, or a homologically non-trivial two-cycle, you can turn on an integral of the B field on that two-cycle. So that's like a Wilson loop in a field theory. It doesn't really affect the field equations, which only depend on the derivatives of B. So you can turn it on at will without changing the background. So this is another parameter of type 2B string theory on the space. When we had type 2B on ADS 5 cross S5, we didn't have any two cycles, so we didn't have any parameters like this. But because this manifold does have a non-trivial two cycle, you have another parameter like this. And actually, you also have the integral of the Ramon-Ramon two form. So, and these two join together into a complex parameter. And similarly, as usual, this G string joins together with the axion to form a complex parameter. So also here you have two complex parameters, just like on the field theory side. So that's one of the tests of this duality. And the mapping between these parameters can be written as follows. So we can parameterize the space of solutions to this equation by just specifying G1 and G2. So that's the choice of a parameterization on this space of fixed points. And of course, then H is specified by solving this equation. And then if we choose that parameterizations, then the parameter 1 over G1 squared plus 1 over G2 squared and the field theory side maps to the inverse deltaon on the string theory side. So that's similar to the mapping in ADS 5 cross S5, where the Young-Mills coupling squared mapped to the string coupling. But here we see that what appears is the sum of the two inverse gauge couplings. And the parameter 1 over G1 squared minus 1 over G2 squared turns out to map to 2 times e to the minus phi times this integral of the B field over the two sphere minus 1/2. And this is when I choose a normalization for this B. So this integral of the B field can be shown to be a periodic variable, just like a Wilson loop in field theory is a periodic variable. And here I normalize the B field so that its periodicity is 1. So this is in a specific normalization such that integral B is the same as integral B plus 1. And in this normalization, one can show that this is the way that the parameters of the two sides map to each other. And again, one can check this duality in many ways, compute, well, correlation functions, dimensions of chiral primary operators, and so on, and it seems to work. So are there any questions about this case before we move on to the non-conformal case? Okay, so of course this theory has nothing to do with the Larsen Young-Mills theory, because this is just a conformal fixed point that has a very different behavior than pure Young-Mills theory. And the question is, can we find some modification of this theory that will lead to a non-conformal theory that might be related to Larsen Young-Mills? And there is actually an easy way to modify this field theory and to get a non-conformal theory. And that's just to change the ranks of these two gauge groups not to be equal anymore. So instead of taking an SUN cross SUN group, let's suppose that we take an SU n plus m times SUN gauge group for some m, which is different from zero. So on the filtery side, of course, we can just, well, we can choose any filtery that we want naively, so we can just make this change. What this corresponds to on the string theory side, so on the string theory side, the original case where all, where the two ends were equal, was when we had just n D3 brains on the conifold. When we change m, that turns out to be, to correspond to adding also D5 brains wrapped on an S2. So it's possible to, well, so there is a deformation of this conifold that blows up, or usually it's called a resolution of this conifold singularity that blows up an S2 and resolves the singularity. And then you can consider D5 brains that are wrapped on this S2 and that still fill the same four dimensions of space as the D3 brains. Of course, then we're interested in the singular limit where this S2 goes to zero size. But even when the S2 goes to zero size, these D5 brains still remain. And in particular, the D5 brains carry some three-brain charge, given because of in the world volume of the D5 brain, there's a term of the form B wedge C4, which means that if there is some non-zero integral of the B field over the S2, then that gives these wrapped five brains an induced three-brain charge. So if we take these MD5 brains on S2 and take the limit where the S2 goes to zero, then these are what are usually called fractional D3 brains because they can carry some fractional D3 brain charge given by this integral of the B field over the S2. And one can argue that when one puts M of these fractional D3 brains in addition to the N D3 brains that we originally had on the conifold, then one can argue that the effect of that on the lower energy field theory is to make this change of SUN to SUN cross M. To SUN plus M. Now, when we make this change, of course, we have to start recomputing what the beta functions are and how this field theory behaves. So, so we know that when M is zero, then we know that this theory flows to the superconformal fixed point in which gamma is equal to minus 1/4, and so we want to discuss now the case where m is not smaller than n. So we expect that when m is not smaller than n, then the renormalization group flow should be quite similar with small differences. So we expect that, for instance, this gamma should be still given by minus 1/4 plus some epsilon, where epsilon would be of order m over n, because we know that it goes to zero when m goes to zero. So we can now compute what are the how the gauge couplings run in this SUN plus M cross SUN theory. So again, we can use the usual formulas of supersymmetric gauge theories to see how the gauge coupling runs. So if you compute how the first gauge coupling runs, then you get the following equation. So we know that when gamma is equal to minus 1/4, this vanishes, and you find that the beta function is given by the following formula. So again, you see that when epsilon goes to zero and m goes to zero, then the beta function vanishes, and we can sit at this fixed point that we were at before. But when they're non-zero, then you do have some flow in general. And if you compute the running coupling of the second gauge group factor, then you find that it's given by minus 3m plus 4 times n plus m epsilon. So you might have hoped that even when we do this small change and choose the ranks not to be equal, you might hope that the theory would still have some strongly coupled fixed point at which both of these beta functions go to zero. But it's easy to see that there's actually no solution to the equation that would set both of these running gauge couplings to zero. So actually, there isn't any more a superconformal fixed point, and this theory is just non-conformal, and the gauge coupling runs. Now, moreover, one can argue that this factor of, well, that this parameter epsilon that I wrote down that labels the deviation of the anomalous dimension from its value of 1/4, it's easy to argue that this epsilon is actually of order m over n squared rather than m over n as one might naively think. And that's because if we take m to minus m, then we end up here with an SUN minus M cross SUN theory, but that's almost the same as the original theory, just with N shifted to N minus M. So when we take M to minus M and also shift N to N minus M, we have to end up with the same anomalous dimension, and it's easy to see that that does not allow any term in epsilon that would go like M over N, because such a term would change sign. So this epsilon has to go at least of order M over N squared. And what that means is that in this limit where M is not smaller than N, and then these last two terms are actually negligible compared to the first term. So as a first approximation, we can just ignore these terms. And then we see that if the beta function, the beta function of one of these gauge group factors is positive and the other beta function is negative. So that's, of course, very bad news, because that means that this theory is not asymptotically free. We don't even have that one of the gauge couplings is, well, we cannot have both gauge couplings being asymptotically free at the same time. And usually, of course, that's a sign of trouble. If we have a gauge theory that's not asymptotically free, then that usually means that it's not well defined and that when we go to high energies, we're going to have to add some more degrees of freedom to even define what that gauge theory is. So we could just give up it at this point and say that we don't know how to define this theory. But following Klebanov and his collaborators will be more brave and assume that we can find some way to define this theory at high energies. And later we'll see indeed how we can do it. So we'll just proceed with this theory. So of course, even though this theory is not asymptotically free, we can just start at some cutoff scale mu, start with this theory, assume that somebody gave us this theory at the scale mu with some specific coupling constants for the two gauge group factors. So we can draw 1/d² and so say that we start from some specific gauge coupling constants for the SUN plus M group and for the SUN group. And then assuming that somebody gave us this theory at the cutoff scale, we can start flowing down in energy. That we could always do, of course, and ask how these gauge couplings behave. And what we see is that as we flow down in energy, one of these gauge couplings becomes weaker and the other one becomes stronger. And it's actually the SUN plus M gauge coupling that becomes stronger and the SUN gauge coupling that becomes weaker. So here I'm drawing the effective couplings of the two gauge group as a function of this renormalization group scale, or more precisely as a function of log of mu in order to be able to draw straight lines. So if you try to, again, just assume that somebody gave you this theory to cut off and flow down in energy, then you see that one of these gauge couplings actually becomes infinite already after a finite flow, while the other one just sits there. So this is, of course, problematic. We don't really know what to do when a gauge coupling becomes infinite. So in order to analyze what happens further, we'll start by making some simplifying assumptions, and then we'll see how we can change them. So the starting point is labeled by three parameters. We have G1, G2, and this superpotential coupling H. And when you do this flow, it's easy to see that actually that 1/g1² plus 1/g2² is almost constant during the flow. At the leading order, it's obviously constant, and one can show that actually also at higher orders in M/n, this is constant. Well, the difference between these two gauge couplings does run as indicated also in this graph. So in order to simplify things, we could start from the case where this constant is very large, meaning that at least one of the gauge couplings is weak. And so that means that, so if we call this, say, G1 and this G2, then that means that as we flow here, G2 will actually be very small at the point where this G1 seems to diverge. And also, for simplification, let's also assume that the superpotential coupling H is much smaller than 1. So what that means is that to analyze the flow, we can more or less, as a first approximation, we can just ignore these two couplings and only discuss the first SUN plus M group factor, which is the factor that becomes strongly coupled. So in this approximation, the gauge theory that we're talking about is approximately just an SUN plus M gauge theory that has with 2N flavors. And again, we neglect the superpotential, and also we neglect the additional SUN gauge interactions. So there are also all these SUN gauge fields, which are almost free. But again, as long as we're in this regime where G2 and H are both small, we can ignore the interactions of these fields. And then we can just ask what happens to this gauge theory as we flow through lower energies. And this is a theory that we know very well. This is just a supersymmetric QCD theory. And because NF is, it's very close to being 2 × n+m, it only differs from that by a small amount when m is much smaller than n, then this theory is in what's called the conformal window of supersymmetric QCD. So if we just had exactly this theory, then we know that in infrared, this flows to a superconformal field theory, which I think you heard about in the lectures about supersymmetry. So in this approximation where we can ignore these couplings, we actually know what happens to this theory in the infrared. And moreover, you also heard that this infrared fixed point that you have has two different descriptions, which are related by Seiberg duality. So the same, we can get to the same fixed point by starting from some different supersymmetric QCD theory that would have a gauge group SU and F minus NC, which in this case is SU N minus M, and that would also have two N flavors, and that would also have some meson fields, and that would have some superpotential of the form W equals MQ Q tilde. So as you heard in the lectures about supersymmetry, there is strong evidence that these two gauge theories, again, when we're now just ignoring completely these other two couplings, so there is strong evidence that these two gauge theories flow to exactly the same theory in the infrared. So in this case, when we come here, then we know that we just end up in this infrared theory, and we can describe this infrared theory in two different languages. We can either describe it as the infrared fixed point of this gauge theory, or we can describe it as the infrared fixed point of this theory. So at least in this limit, we do understand exactly what's going on, but now we have to go away from this limit and turn back on these coupling constants and see how they affect the flow. So let's start by adding the effect of this superpotential coupling H. So I guess I already erased the superpotential coupling, so let me rewrite it. So we now want to add this superpotential coupling. And again, as long as it's small, then it won't really affect this flow too much. Then the coupling, the superpotential will only start affecting the dynamics when we go to very low energies. So we're going to flow very close to this fixed point before this superpotential starts having an effect. So to some approximation, we can sort of first flow to the fixed point and then ask what's the effect of adding this superpotential coupling H. And it turns out that the superpotential coupling H is actually a relevant deformation of this superpotential fixed point. You can compute the anomalous dimensions of these quark fields A and B at the fixed point, and you can show that this anomalous dimension is actually less than minus 1/4, so that this superpotential is actually relevant as a deformation of this superconformal field theory. So that means that, again, when we deform this theory by adding the superpotential coupling, then actually when we flow to low energies, H actually becomes very large. So at first sight, that looks like bad news because it means that these superpotential interactions become large and we can't ignore them anymore. And we can't just approximate the theory by this supersymmetric QCD theory as we did before. But in fact, we can also describe the same deformation of this fixed point in this dual language of starting from this so-called magnetic theory of the SUN minus M gauge group. And in the magnetic description, then the same deformation, so the magnetic theory maps these, well, so one can argue that in the magnetic theory, the same deformation is described schematically by adding a superpotential of the form H times M squared. It's not completely trivial to do this because when we do the duality, we can replace the trace of A times B by one of the meson fields. This is what was called QQ tilde in the discussion of QCD, and you can discuss that by the meson field. Here you don't have exactly this double trace operator, but you have a single trace operator, so there are some subtleties here, but I think I don't have time to go into them. So in any case, what you get by a more detailed analysis is that in this magnetic description, this deformation by H just turns out to give a mass to these meson fields. And since it becomes large as we go to the infrared, then at low energies, one can just integrate out these meson fields and end up with an effective superpotential, which just takes the form 1 over H times some quartic superpotential of these Qs, which again, I won't write down the indices exactly, but one can argue that, but this is what you get just by integrating out the meson fields from the superpotential. And in this language, we see that as H goes to infinity, when we continue flowing, this parameter 1 over H actually goes to 0. So in this dual description, and also the mass of the mesons go to infinity, so you can ignore them. So what you find is that in this dual description, after we added this deformation parameter H, then we actually just end up with an SUN minus M theory, again with NF equals to 2N, and now with no superpotential anymore, and also with no additional meson fields, or at least just with a very small superpotential. So that's the effect of adding H. Now we can ask what happens when we add when we turn on, again, the gauge coupling parameter G2, which is the gauge coupling of this SUN gauge group factor. So in this description, so this gauge is part of the flavor group of this theory, which is the same as the flavor group of the original theory. So we know how to couple the theory back to these SUN gauge fields. And what you get when you do this gauging is actually you find an SUN cross SUN minus M theory, which is actually almost identical to the theory that you had before. So G2 is, so at this scale, well, so we're working at well, so this SUN minus M theory is actually at, well, okay, sorry, I should have been more precise. So here, because of the superpotential, the superpotential goes to zero, and that means that the theory that we have here is just the SUN minus M theory, again, with NF equals to N, at its superconformal fixed point, so at some specific value of the gauge coupling of this theory, which corresponds to its superconformal fixed point, and then for Ed, without any superpotential. So this is, again, just a supersymmetric QCD theory in the conformal window that flows to some superconformal fixed point, and that's what you would get in this approximation where you ignore G2. So if we now, again, assume that G2 was small enough so that you could have ignored it in the renormalization group flow so far, but now we turn it on at some lower energy scale, then what you find is, so we now have this SUN cross SUN minus M theory, which is actually almost identical to the theory that we started with, except that we have N minus M except for N plus M. And we now start off this theory with the gauge coupling of this SUN minus M theory at some strong coupled value and with G2 at weak coupling. But what happens now if you continue the renormalization group flow for this theory, then just like before, the SUN plus M gauge coupling became stronger and the SUN gauge coupling became weaker. Here, if you start the flow from here, then it's actually this SUN factor of the bigger gauge group of the two that would want to become larger and the, or say, grows as you flow. And the gauge coupling factor of this SUN minus M factor that actually. So what you have is basically if we here at this scale change variables to these SUN cross SUN minus M variables, which, as I said, at least in some limit, describe the same theory, then the claim is that if we continue flowing, then here the SUN minus M gauge coupling starts becoming larger, smaller. The SUN gauge coupling starts becoming larger, and you end up with something very similar to what you had before, just with N shifted to N minus M. So let me just try to summarize what we did. So when G2 and H were both exactly zero, we said that we can describe the fixed point that we end up with in two different languages, either using this SUN plus M gauge theory or using an SUN minus M gauge theory. Now, when we added these additional couplings, then we didn't really flow all the way to the infrared here. So these two different descriptions were not really exactly the same at the scale where we added these additional couplings, but they can be chosen to be as close together as we want to. So we don't flow all the way to the infrared, but we flow very close to the infrared fixed point, very well below the scale of the dynamical scales of these theories. So these two theories are very close together. And to a good approximation, we can just replace this description that we had in terms of the SUN plus M gauge group by the dual description in terms of the SUN minus M gauge group. So that alternative description, again, if we just started off here at some cutoff scale using this alternative language, then it will not give us exactly the same theory, but it gives us a theory that's very close to the original theory that we started from. And in fact, one could argue that the distance between these two theories decreases as we continue flowing. So eventually, when we flow far enough further into the infrared, then these two different starting points, so we could either start with this SUN plus M gauge theory at some scale mu1, or we could start with this other SUN minus M gauge theory, say, at the scale mu2. One could argue that these two renormalization group flows actually come closer and closer together as we flow to the infrared, so that as far as the infrared physics is concerned, which is what we're going to be interested in eventually, we could describe the theories in either of these two languages, and that will, and there will be a very small difference between them as we go further to the infrared. So this was maybe a bit fast, but I hope it was clear. And if you're interested in more rigorous descriptions of this whole renormalization group flow process, then a good place to read about them is in Matt Strasser's recent review of these cascading gauge theories. So are there any questions about these two different descriptions that we can use for this theory? Well, so again, so here, so when you turn on the scuffling, then you don't really flow here all the way to the infrared. You're still left with some finite value of h, and then this superpotential, if you rewrite it in terms of, well, so these q's are just, are now going to be just the new a's and b's, which are the bifundamentals of these gauge groups, and you end up with exactly the same superpotential again, possibly with some different value of h, but again, h is, well, you can follow the flow and see that you do end up with the same theory. Any other questions? Okay, so now that we did the story once, of course, we can continue doing it again and again. So as we continue flowing, then here this SUN gauge coupling will become strong. And again, we can replace this by an approximate dual description that will now involve an SUN minus 2M gauge group times this SUN minus M gauge group that we had before. And we can continue doing this more and more as we flow to the infrared. So we find that here we had N plus M as the bigger gauge group, here N minus M, and so on. We can just continue flowing, and the energy gap between each of these two changes of description that we make remains finite, and it's related to this, well, to this constant parameter that we choose here that was related to G string. So this was 1 over G string, and it's related to G string times M in such a way that if G string times M is very large, then the flow is very fast, because you see here that the speed of the flow depends on G squared times M. So when GSM is large, then these flows happen very fast, and the energy scales of these different, where these different descriptions are valid, are very close together. While when GSM is much smaller than one, then actually these flows are slow, and there's a big gap between the energy scales where these things happen. I guess I should emphasize that I was always talking about these field theories in the language of these SUN plus M gauge groups, but of course, at least one of these gauge groups is always strongly coupled, so it doesn't really, well, so these descriptions in terms of these gauge couplings are never really effective descriptions that allow us to do computations, because these descriptions are always strongly coupled, so when we do this cascade, we're really just exchanging one strongly coupled description by another strongly coupled description, but still, this does give an effective way to understand the qualitative behavior of this flow, as we'll see. And then as we continue flowing, so if we suppose that N is some multiple of M, say that N is K times M, then eventually as we continue flowing, we'll end up with some, say, SU3M cross SU2M gauge theory, then another. So each of these steps is called a duality cascade because of the shape of this figure. So then we end up with some SU2M cross SUM theory, and finally, we just end up with an SUM gauge theory, and there are no additional flavors. So here we ended up with SUM cross SU0, so we don't have any bifundamentals anymore. So if we follow this through to the last step, which of course we have to be careful about, because here we're assuming that M is much smaller than N, so we have to be more careful in these last steps, but one can do it more carefully. And at the last step, we just end up with the SUM pure Super-Young-Mills theory, which of course is the theory that we're really interested in describing. So the claim is that if we start from such an SUN cross SUN N plus M theory at high energies and flow down to the infrared, then the infrared behavior will be very similar to that of just the SUM pure Super-Young-Mills theory, which is the theory which we want to understand its lower energy properties. And again, the question of whether we can really decouple, but of course at higher energies we have all these additional degrees of freedom coming from these cascading gauge groups. And again, the ratio between, say, the Super-Young-Mills scale of this theory and the characteristic scales of these additional gauge groups is determined in terms of G string times M. So when G string times M is much bigger than one, then it turns out that there's no separation of scales. So here we don't, so in this regime, we don't really get the Super-Young-Mills theory separated from the other degrees of freedom, but of course that's good because, as we said, we need to have no separation of scales if we hope to have a supergravity description, which is what we'll turn to next. But in the opposite limit, where G string M is much smaller than one, then there is a separation of scales, so lambda Super-Young-Mills is much smaller than the scale of any additional degrees of freedom here. So in this range of parameters, when G string M is much smaller than one, then the lower energy behavior of this cascade is going to be very similar to the lower energy behavior of the Super-Young-Mills theory. And so it will give us a way to construct the superhuman wealth theory that we're really interested in. So this is what happens if you go down in energy. Now, of course, we also need to still find some way to define this theory in the ultraviolet, because it's not asymptotically free. But it's pretty obvious from here that we can just continue. Well, we can just try to, in some sense, flow the other way by just continuing this cascade all the way to bigger and bigger values of n. So we can just continue going to higher and higher values of n. I don't really mean that we're going to flow here against the renormalization group, because that's not really possible. What I mean is that we can take a limit of n going to infinity and also this renormalization scale mu going to infinity in a correlated way, such that you would get this cascade going all the way to infinity, or at least to a higher cutoff as you want. So the way to define this theory in the ultraviolet is to take this type of weird limit, where you take the cutoff to infinity and n to infinity in a correlated way, while keeping all the lower energy parameters fixed. So say keeping fixed the effective theory at some lower energy scale mu one, and formally this gives us a definition of an ultraviolet definition of this theory, which is good for all energy scales when we really take this limit of mu going to infinity. Now, of course, as I mentioned at the beginning, what that really means is that even though we started out trying to describe this theory of nd through bins and m fractional through bins on the conifold, what we end up with is really a theory that has n going to infinity. So it's not really describing the near horizon limit of anything. It's, or maybe of some infinite number of brains, something that doesn't really make sense. But still, this theory can be defined by this limiting procedure. And it seems that it does give you a reasonable field theory, even though, of course, it's not a standard field theory. Usually in field theory, we define the theory by taking the cutoff to infinity and sitting at some fixed couplings corresponding to some ultraviolet fixed point, either free or strongly coupled. Here, the definition of the high energy behavior is much more subtle, but it seems like it does exist, and it's some generalization of the standard field theories, and it seems like it does make sense. So this is the field theory description of the duality cascade, and next we'll turn to the trying to find a gravity description for the same cascade. So are there any questions first about the field theory description of this cascade? Yes. That's right, but you can do better arguments. So in these last steps, so these arguments that we did are not valid, but you can do more sophisticated arguments. It is possible in a systematic way to not do this approximation that m is not smaller than n, and to see how the last steps of this cascade work. Maybe at the end I'll describe in a bit more detail what these last steps behave like. But I didn't really use too strongly here this fact that m should be much smaller than n. I only used it in some small ways, and it is possible to avoid making that assumption and to really control also these last steps. So I won't have time to go into the details here. Any additional questions? Yes. Sorry, what was that? Right. Well, the field theory, of course, it's believed that in any renormalization group flow, you always lose some degrees of freedom. So it's not too surprising that the number of degrees of freedom go down. But because these field theories are very strongly coupled, we don't really have any way to control how fast you lose degrees of freedom. So there's no real direct argument to see in field theory that So I gave sort of the hand-waving arguments for why it's believed that the loss of degrees of freedom can be described by these effective theories that have less and less degrees of freedom. But these were hand-waving arguments. One can make them a bit more rigorous, but we don't have real control over the number of degrees of freedom in this flow because it's a strongly coupled field theory. So when it's close to one of these conformal fixed points, I guess you can estimate the number of degrees of freedom because you know the central charge of each of these conformal field theories. So in this case, where both couplings are small, then you can really see the number of degrees of freedom and see that it goes down in the right way. But if you're far from, so if you're at a generic point, which is what we really want to be, where these G2 and H are generic, then you never really pass too close to any of these fixed points. And then we don't really have any good methods to estimate the number of degrees of freedom. However, we will see in a few minutes from the gravity description that the gravity description also indicates a very similar reduction in the number of degrees of freedom. So that will give us a bit more confidence that this very strange picture of how the renormalization group flow works is really correct. But unfortunately, we don't have any more precise way to really see that the reduction in the number of degrees of freedom goes exactly along these lines. Any more questions? And well, maybe just one more comment about the field theory. So as I said, these two different effective descriptions with different ends are not really completely equivalent because we don't flow all the way to the infrared, but they become closer and closer together as we flow further along. And then because we're eventually going to take n to infinity and the Ernst scale to infinity, then when we start from a very large mu, then we have a very long way to flow until we get to the infrared. And there these different flows do have enough time to really come close together. So at least when you start from the large values of n, then these different effective descriptions, it can't be shown that they really converge very fast to give the same theory at low energies. So next, I want to describe the gravity dual of the solution. So let's do that. So we started on the gravity side, we started from this ADS5 cross T11 theory, which was dual to the case of m equals zero when there wasn't any flow. So we know that if we don't have these additional brains, then we just had this ADS5 cross T11, which is dual to SUN cross SUN. And now we want to deform this into SUN plus m. And as we said, that corresponds to adding some m additional D5 brains wrapped on some two cycle theory in this geometry. These D5 bands are a source for the three-form field in M theory, in type 2B string theory. So what we should do here, so the way to include the effect of these D5 bands here is to have M units of Ramon-Ramon three-form flux on the S3 in this T11. So just like when we put N D3 bands, we have N units of five-form flux on the space transverse to them. Similarly, one of the effects of having M D5 brains on the background is that we should have these M units of three-form flux. So we need to find some solution which is approximately this ADS5 cross T11, but which also have these M units of three-form flux in it. And of course, these three-form flux back react on the geometry, so they modify the geometry such that it's not just ADS5 cross T11. And in fact, so if you try to solve the field equations, trying to look for a solution which is approximately ADS5 cross T11, but which includes also these m additional units of three-form flux, then what you find just by solving the equations of motion, so the first thing that you find is that the integral of B2 is no longer constant now in this geometry because there is a source for this integral of B2 coming from the wedge product, well, coming from F3 dot F5, there's also some five-form flux in this geometry. And what you find is that this integral of B2 is no longer constant, but rather it goes like 3 times to string M times the log of some radial direction R divided by R0. So we're trying to find a solution where the metric of this T11 and also of the ADS has some dependence on some radial direction, which is what we expect to describe the renormalization group flow. And what you find, again, by solving the equations of motion, and the solution was first found by Klebanov and Seitlin, and well, following a paper by Klebanov and Ekrasov, is that you find this behavior for the integral of B2. And that's already a pretty good sign because you remember that we mapped this integral of B2, at least when we were in the conformal point, we map this to 1 over g1 squared minus 1 over g2 squared in some way. And this is the coupling that logarithmically runs in the field theory. And you find that you actually have exactly, you find exactly the same logarithmic coupling here from the string theory point of view as you find in the field theory. Of course, in the field theory, it's as a function of the renormalization group scale. Well, here it's as a function of the radial position, but one can relate them in some ways. And so that's one consistency check that shows us that we're really having a similar picture on the gravity side and on the field theory side. On both sides, we have this logarithmic flow of 1 over g1 squared minus 1 over g2 squared. And of course, even though this field theory is strongly coupled, then as we saw, we can compute exactly what this flow is. So this equation is exact despite the strong coupling. And so it's, we should be able to reproduce it all, also on the string theory side in this case. And indeed, we do in this way. Similarly, one can compute the phi-form flux in the solution. The phi-form flux is now no longer constant in the presence of both an SNS and Ramondamone three-form fields. Then the phi-form flux actually is not conserved anymore because it has an additional contribution from the different three-forms. And what one finds is that the, so this was the integral over this S2. If you compute the total phi-form flux on the S5, which in the original solution was just given by n, then here you find that it's actually given by n0 plus some number times z string m squared log of r over r0. So also this phi-form flux, which originally measured for us n the number of d3 bins, we see that this also runs logarithmically. And that, again, exactly matches with this picture that we had of these renormalization group flows on the field theory side, where also we had effective descriptions with the different values of n at different energy scales. And indeed, you can again verify that the rate at which this effective rank n changes in the field theory is exactly the same as the rate in which this integral of F5, which is in some sense is an effective number of D3 brains, changes in the dual background. Now, of course, here this change seems completely continuous. Well, here when we did these different effective descriptions and really jumped in discrete steps. But we should remember that, well, or I should have mentioned, I guess, that these effective gravity solutions are only good approximations. So, of course, this was a good approximation only when g string n was much bigger than 1. And these solutions that I'm going to describe are also are good approximations only in the limit that g string times m is much bigger than 1. Otherwise, well, you can already see from here that otherwise you have a big, it's not obvious from here. But yeah, you can compute the curvatures and see that when g string m is much bigger than 1, you have small curvatures. And otherwise, you have large curvatures. And as we said, in this case, that g string m is much bigger than 1, then these different cascade steps that we make are actually very close together. So it's not too surprising that this whole process looks continuous from the gravity point of view. And again, the rate at which this rank changes is the same as the rate that you get from these hand-waving field theory arguments. So, well, I won't write down the exact solution that you find by these methods, but the solution at least at, well, the solution at large values of R, where we're in this regime that n is much bigger than m, is actually rather simple. So it incorporates these fluxes, and the metric looks like approximately, again, for large values of R. So it looks quite similar to the metric of ADS5 plus T11, except that it has some logarithmic corrections. So we can write it in the following form. So if I did not have these square root of log factors, then this would just be the metric. So this, without the square root of log, then this is just one way to write the metric of ADS5, and this would then just be the metric of T11. And really, the only change that you find in this region of large R is that you have these additional logarithmic factors, which enable you to incorporate these logarithmic changes in the effective rank of the gauge group and in the B field. So the form of the solution asymptotically is really very close to this ADS5 plus T11 solution, just with, in some sense, a radius of curvature that varies logarithmically in a way that's consistent with the way that this three-form or five-form flux varies logarithmically. So, So the theory never really becomes conformal in the UV. The rank just keeps growing, and this agrees with this UV completion that we suggested on the field theory side, where we just take this this cascade picture all the way to infinity and use that to define a UV completion of the theory. So are there any questions about this? Yes. Yeah, so in the solution, the deltaon is still constant. That's right. So even though this B field that we identified with 1 over G1 squared minus 1 over G2 squared flows, G string is a constant, and indeed it's still an arbitrary constant, so you can still have the solution for arbitrary values of G string, just like on the field theory side. We could do all these cascades for arbitrary values of 1 over G1 squared plus 1 over G2 squared, and that's really the crucial thing from our point of view, because we want to have this dimensionless parameter that would enable us to interpolate between these two different regimes. So the fact that we can tune G-string arbitrarily is what enables us to go between this regime where we really get the super Young Mohs theory separated from the additional degrees of freedom, and this other regime where we don't have the separation of scales, but where we do have a good supergravity description. So are there any additional questions about this? Yes. So it still has a boundary. Well, R goes to infinity is still a boundary, and it's still infinitely far away, just like it was in ADS. But of course, the details near the boundary are different from ADS, and this log factor does play an important role. So it has to be. So this is not an asymptotically ADS space, and one has to worry about whether this field theory is really well defined. So for instance, you can ask whether you can use this gravitational background to compute correlation functions and whether you can get sensible answers and so on. And indeed, one can show that it is possible that even though this background is not asymptotically ADS, one can generalize the usual methods for computing correlation functions by putting in sources at the boundary and so on. So these methods can be generalized to this type of spaces, and one can get reasonable answers which agree with the field theory answers, even though at first sight it might look like you don't have a chance of getting reasonable answers because the n goes to infinity at the boundary, so you might think that you would get various divergences, but it is in fact possible to get rid of all of these divergences and get finite answers for all the correlation functions in this background. So any other questions? Okay, so far I've discussed just the high energy behavior of this background. One more statement to make about the high energy background is how the symmetries are realized in the story. So as we said, when we were in the conformal case, we had this SU2 cross SU2 cross U1B cross U1R global symmetry. When we make this change to SUN plus M cross SUN, then it turns out that there's actually no anomaly-free U1 gauge group anymore. This U1 that we defined before is broken by an anomaly to a Z2M subgroup. So the global symmetry of this non-conformal theory is just SU2 cross SU2 cross U1 cross Z2M. And then, of course, what we expect from the field theory point of view is that when we go down to low energies, then this is the same symmetry breaking pattern from the anomaly that we have just in the Prior-Young-Mohs theory. And we expect in the Prior-Young-Mohs theory that this Z2M will be spontaneously then broken to a Z2, leaving M a different vacua. So that's what we expect from the field theory side. Now, what I described here so far was just the ultraviolet region. So in this ultraviolet region, we should see all the symmetries that are not spontaneously broken. So we should see these SU2 cross SU2 cross U1B cross Z2M symmetries. It's not hard to see that indeed in this background, well, so first of all, I guess I didn't mention this, but this T11 manifold has an isometry symmetry, which is exactly SU2 cross SU2 cross U1, and that's how the symmetry is matched originally in this conformal case, where this U1 isometry was identified with the U1R symmetry of this conformal field theory. You can then show that when you deform the background into this cascading background, then the existence of this three-form flux on the S3 actually precisely breaks this U1 isometry to a Z2M symmetry, which is the only symmetry that keeps this Ramond-Ramond field constant. So you can see precisely this, the same SU2 cross SU2 cross Z2M global symmetry also in this gravity dual. And you can also see this U1 baryon number. This U1 baryon number symmetry is actually not a geometrical symmetry here in this dual description, but rather, well, as you've probably heard, global symmetries in the field theory are mapped by the ADA's CFT correspondence to gauge symmetries in the bulk. And the gauge symmetry, which is associated to this U invariant number symmetry, actually comes from taking the Ramon-Ramon four-form potential and integrating it over the S3. So this gives some U1 gauge field from the point of view of the field theory of this ADS or on this five-dimensional space. And this U1 gauge field is the field that maps to the baryon number symmetry. So there is a precise agreement between the symmetries on both sides in the UV. So now we need to ask, in the gravity side, so far I described what happens at large values of R. It's easy to see that when we take R to small values, then something will go wrong here. I mean, these logs go to zero. You start getting singularities if you assume that the background takes exactly this form. And indeed, the first attempts to see what happens at R equals zero ended up, well, just by trying to solve the gravity equations all the way down to R equals zero, ended up finding singular solutions. And this was resolved in a paper by Klebanov and Strassler. And what they did is they noticed that the original solutions that people were looking for were solutions that actually preserved this Z2M symmetry. So they didn't involve any of the fields that break the Z2M symmetry. However, from the field theory point of view, we expect that this Z2 symmetry should be spontaneously broken. So one should look for solutions where indeed this Z2M is spontaneously broken to a Z2 and turn on additional fields. And they found that there are indeed additional solutions if you allow for this symmetry breaking. So there are completely smooth solutions also in the infrared region when you allow this symmetry breaking. These solutions are quite complicated, so I won't write them down explicitly, but I'll just mention one feature of these solutions. So from the point of view of this conifold singularity that we started from, then you can show that these global SU2 cross SU2 cross U1R symmetries of this field theory actually act in a simple way on these Zs. So the SU2 cross SU2 is just an SO4 symmetry that rotates these different Zs, and the U1 symmetry is just the symmetry that changes the overall phase of all of these Zs. And there is actually a simple deformation of this background by adding on an epsilon here. And this deformation preserves the SO4 symmetry that rotates these different coordinates, but it breaks the U1 symmetry because this epsilon has some fixed phase, and it actually breaks it exactly to Z2 because you still have the symmetry taking Z2 minus Z, but you don't have any more arbitrary phase rotations of the Zs. So this deformation realizes this spontaneous breaking of the U1R to the Z2 that you expect. So the solution is indeed related to deforming the metric of the original cone that we had, which was this conifold metric that I wrote down, deforming it in a way that corresponds to this deformed conifold. So this, the manifold with this deformed definition is called a deformed conifold. And the metric of this deformed conifold is incorporated in the solution of Klebanov and Strassler. Again, as I mentioned, the metric of this theory preserves the full U1R symmetry. You only see that it's broken when you include also the effects of the three form, and that's also visible here before you deform, and then after you deform, then after you deform by this epsilon, then that's this U1R is spontaneously broken to a Z2. So, so what the solution looks like sort of qualitatively, so we see that, so asymptotically the solution looks like, so if this is the radial direction, then asymptotically, the solution looks like this ADS 5 cross T11, but with a radius of curvature, which is proportional to log of r over 0 to the power 1/4, as is evident from the solution that I wrote down. Then as we go down in energies, you can see that as you go close to the infrared, so I guess I should have mentioned that the topology of this T11 manifold, so this T11 manifold has a topology which is the same as that of the direct product of S2 cross S3. It has one non-trivial 2-cycle and one non-trivial 3-cycle, as I've used before but never explicitly mentioned. And what you can show in this exact solution is that in the solution, the radius of the S2 inside the T11 actually shrinks to zero size at the minimal radial coordinate. So there is some minimal radial coordinate, say r equals zero. And the radius of the S2 shrinks to zero size near this minimal coordinate, such that the solution here looks like R7 process 3, and actually the behavior near this infrared region is very similar to the behavior we saw yesterday for the Mollison and Unia solutions. Both of them go to R7 process 3 in this infrared region, and of course the basic reason for that is that on this S3 there are these m units of flux, so the S3 cannot shrink, but the S2 can shrink and does shrink in this infrared region, and there is just a smooth solution of this type. The solution, well, it can almost be written down explicitly. You can write down differential equations for all the different metric components and so on, and some of these differential equations can be solved exactly. Some of them can only be implicitly solved, but you can at least numerically compute the metrics on the space and start doing computations on it. And again, these solutions depend on this parameter epsilon, which parameterizes this spontaneous symmetry breaking of the U1R to Z2. So these solutions realize the precise symmetry breaking pattern that you expect from the point of view of this low energy SUM gates theory. And in particular, you have m different solutions depending on the different choices of the phase of this epsilon. And these m different solutions are identified from the point of view of the low energy theory with the m different vacua of this SUM pure super Young Mohs theory. And again, this solution, so this solution still, even after this deformation, it still has a constant dilaton, even after the deformation. And as I mentioned, when G string M is much bigger than 1, then you have weak small curvatures everywhere. And you can choose this G string to be small, and then you also have small coupling everywhere. So the supergravity approximation is a good approximation. Of course, if you want to do string theory on this background, then that's much harder because there are always Ramon-Ramon fields in this background, both the 3-form and the 5-form. So doing exact string theory computations in this background would be rather complicated, but at least in this regime, one can compute anything one wants in the supergravity approximation. So are there any questions about this? Well, epsilon is not really a parameter. I mean, well, it's sort of determined by, I mean, when you flow to the infrared, you just find a specific absolute value of epsilon. And from the point of view of the gauge theory, then that maps to this energy scale where this cascade ends. So you start here from some energy scale, you continue flowing down, and then there is some specific energy scale, UK, where you end up just with this gauge group. So that energy scale that you find here is related to this epsilon, but it's not a free parameter. I mean, it's determined when you fix what happens in the UV, then it's just determined by the solution. So really the only parameter of the solution is this G string. Any other questions? Okay, so like we did in the previous cases, let's quickly discuss what are the properties of this background and whether it's in the same universality class as QCD or not. So we can first ask to see confinement in this background. And again, it's rather simple to see confinement in this background. You can again insert external charged fields by just putting in which you measure by the Wilson loop, by just putting in some strings here coming in from infinity. So put in some fundamental string and some fundamental string in the opposite orientation. You ask how it goes. And as in the other examples that we saw, the string wants to stretch all the way to the lowest possible value of R, but then it just stays there and eventually goes back out. So if these two ends of the string are far enough from together, then you get a linear potential between them corresponding to the tension of the string where it sits at this point. So you do find here that the poor contact work potential goes like some T string times the distance between the quark and the anti quark. And again, you can compute exactly the confining string tension. The next qualitative question that we wanted to ask was about having a mass gap and being able to compute the spectrum. So again, as usual, when you have a supergravity background, it's not hard to compute the spectrum. You can just solve the field equations for the fluctuations of all the gravity fields here in this background and compute it. And so you can compute the spectrum and see what is the mass spectrum that you find. And as I mentioned, as usual, when the gravity approximation is valid, then all the masses squared that you find from the gravity are much smaller than string tensions. So you have this separation of scales. One slightly problematic feature of the Klebanov-Strasser background is that this background actually turns out not to have a mass gap. And the way to see that, well, so first you can see that from the gravity point of view by just solving the field equations for all the fluctuations. But this is also clear from the field theory point of view, even though at this last step of the cascade, when you had this SUM theory, you might think that this theory should have a mass gap. If you actually go one step up and you have this SU2M theory, SU2M cross SUM theory, then actually in this case, so from the point of view of this SU2M theory, then you have an SU2M theory with a number of flavors, which is also equal to 2M, because you have these two by fundamentals of SU2M cross SUM. So we have a theory, again, if you ignore the gauge coupling of this SUM factor, you just have a supersymmetric UCD theory with a number of flavors equal to the number of colors. And in this case, you know that actually the dynamics is quite different. This theory does not flow to a superconformal fixed point in the infrared, but rather it has a deformed moduli space given by some equation like determinant M minus UB tilde equals lambda to the 2M. I'm sorry that I'm using M here in, I guess throughout this lecture, I've been using M both for the mesons and for the number of five rays, but I hope this was not too confusing. So you actually have a deformed moduli space of this type. So if you ignore the gauge coupling of this SUM gauge theory, then you find that then you see that actually you have to turn on a vacuum expectation value either for the mesons or for the baryons. The mesons, and so you have many different vacui of this field theory, and you can ask, which vacuum of this field theory does this cascading background correspond to? And it's easy to see that in terms of the global symmetry, the meson fields, all of them are charged under the SU2 cross SU2, while the baryon fields are, of course, charged under the baryon number symmetry. In this background, the SU2 cross SU2 symmetry is not broken. I didn't write down the explicit metric, but the full metric of this background still has an SU2 cross SU2 symmetry. So what that means is that in this background, you must have a non-zero VEV for these baryon fields. Again, the baryon fields now are these baryons of this SU2M theory that you get in the penultimate step of this cascade. So in the vacuum, you must have B non-zero, so you must have a spontaneous breaking of the baryon number symmetry. And so I've argued that this must be the case when I ignore the gauge coupling of this additional SUM gauge factor, but you can also then turn it on and argue that this still must take place. And basically by continuity, you still must break spontaneously at least one of these symmetries. And in this background, the U1 baryon number symmetry is actually spontaneously broken. And of course, that means that you must have some massless field, which is the Goldstone boson of this spontaneously broken symmetry. And so indeed, when you compute the spectrum of this theory, then you find that in the spectrum, you have exactly one massless complex scalar field. So as usual, in a supersymmetric field theory, you cannot have just one massless real field, which is the Goldstone boson. It always comes together with a partner of opposite parity. So you get this full complex massless scalar field. So that's one sort of slightly disturbing feature of this background, that the low energy theory here is not really just this SUM superangles, but it also includes this baryon field, which is made out of degrees of freedom that are not even there in this SUM superangles theory. But nevertheless, you can still argue that this SU2M cross SUM theory still flows to something at low energies, which looks like the SUM theory, plus this one additional massless field, which at low energies just decouples from this SUM theory. So one can still argue that at low energies, you can get this SUM theory to as good an approximation as you want, as long as you're careful to correctly take into account the effects of this one additional massless scalar field. So up to this subtlety, you do see the usual features that you want of the formation of a mass gap and of a discrete spectrum of blue ball fields, which you can compute exactly. And similarly, you can compute all the other features of this background. So again, you can compute instanton effects. You can see that when you put in external quarks, you have a baryon vertex. You can compute various condensates and so on. And so you can compute anything you want in this background. And again, everything that you compute except for this one single massless scalar field behaves qualitatively in exactly the same way as in the Super-Yang-Mills theory. So this gives us another example of a theory with a dimensionless parameter such that in one limit you get a good gravity description and in the other limit you just get at low energies the Super-Yang-Mills theory. So let me just summarize the advantages and disadvantages of this specific construction as a way to approach QCD. So the big advantage of this solution is that, as I mentioned, we have weak coupling. So in the limit of large lambda here, we have weak coupling and weak curvatures everywhere. So we can do computations. So that's a nice feature, but this is a feature that we had also in the Maldacena Nunez background, so that is not an advantage compared to that background. But the very nice thing about this background is that even when you take the limit of lambda going to zero, so when you take the limit of lambda going to zero, you of course get very high curvatures, as you might expect, so gravity breaks down, but you still have weak coupling everywhere. This coupling constant was, I mean, you can choose it to be independent of, well, you can tune G string M and G string sort of independently in the large M limit, and you can get a solution that has weak coupling everywhere, even when you take this limit. So, and this is unlike the previous two cases we discussed, where either you had the Schwarz firebands, or when you tried to take this limit, you ended up with strong coupling. So this theory is much more similar to what we would expect to get of a large and Yang-Mills theory. As I mentioned at the beginning, we expect that the string dual of large and Yang-Mills theory should have weak coupling. And here we really do find a theory that has weak coupling in the limit of lambda going to zero. Of course, we can't really completely control the equations as lambda goes to zero because we don't know how to solve string theory in this background. We only have the gravity approximation, but at least it looks like you can take the coupling to be as small as you want. And of course, it would be interesting to study this further. So that's a very big advantage of this background. On the other hand, this background has two disadvantages, which I've already mentioned. One disadvantage is that the UV theory in this case is not a standard field theory. As I mentioned, one can define it in field theory and also in gravity, but it takes quite a lot of work and it's subtle, unlike the Polsinski-Strasser case that we described before. And the other disadvantage is that there's no mass gap in this case, and that there is this additional massless scalar field, which we don't really want in order to describe the SUM super Yang-Mills theory. And this fact that there's no mass gap is also a problem if we now want to break supersymmetry in this background and, say, deform it by Iglino mass. Then you have to be careful because you have this additional massless field here, and when you do a deformation, it could potentially become tachyonic or develop a potential and so on. So it's not so obvious how to break supersymmetry in this background. So in this background, it's more subtle how to break the supersymmetry. So are there any more questions about this Klebanov-Strasser background? Okay, so let me summarize what we did in these three lectures. So in these lectures, we constructed three examples of theories that have this general property, that in one limit, they have a good supergravity approximation, and in the other limit, they go over to super Yang-Mills theory. And in all of these examples, we saw that even in the lambda going to infinity limit, which is very far from Yang-Mills, we found the same qualitative properties of QCD, which are mysterious perturbatively. We found confinement, a mass gap, and all these other things. So it looks like in all of these examples, the interpolation between these two limits should be rather continuous, and it doesn't look like there are any phase transitions as one does this interpolation. And so all of these backgrounds can be studied extensively and have been studied extensively in this limit of lambda going to infinity. And as I said, in that limit, you can compute anything you want. And of course, the interesting thing would be to study this opposite limit of lambda going to zero. And in this limit, all of these theories should just become the QCD string or the supersymmetric Yang-Mills string. So in this limit, these do become the string dual of Yang-Mills theory or super Yang-Mills theory, depending on whether you preserve or break supersymmetry. So, well, one nice thing about this, of course, is that it really tells us that, Atuft had all these rather somewhat hand-waving arguments that there should be a string dual of Yang-Mills theory. But here we see that we have really a precise in principle construction of what the QCD string is. We just have to take either one of these theories, take lambda going to zero, and by the arguments that we said, whatever string theory we get in this limit, which is a well-defined limit in the string theory, where we just have to change some parameters of the background, which is something that we know how to do in principle in string theory. When we take that limit, we will get the string dual of the pure Yang-Mills theory. So that teaches us various interesting things. So for instance, it tells us that that the QCD string is just some background of the type 2B string. And this is, of course, somewhat surprising. In the historical development of string theory, even though it started from trying to describe the QCD string, then at some point it evolved to describing these other string theories. And for a while it was thought that probably the QCD string is a completely different string from the string theories that we use for describing quantum gravity and flat space and all these other nice things that you heard about string theory. What these constructions tell us is that the QCD string is the same as the type 2B string, however, in a very complicated background. So, of course, it has to be in some highly curved background. That's what we get from all of these descriptions. And as I said, there are arguments why this has to be the case. These backgrounds are always Rorff backgrounds, where you have the four-dimensional background depends on some radial, the four-dimensional metric depends on some radial coefficient. And in all of these constructions, also, when we take this limit of lambda going to zero, we find that there are Ramon-Ramon fields. So it looks like these things are essential properties of the QCD string. But this tells us that there should be some highly curved, warped, and with Ramon-Ramon fields background of the type 2B string, which is the QCD string. And of course, it would be interesting to find exactly what this background is. One somewhat confusing feature, of course, is that we constructed three different ways to get at the string theory. And naively, these different ways would lead us to completely different string theories when lambda goes to zero. But of course, we know that we should end up with the same string theory because we should just get the string dual of super Young-Mohs or Young-Mohs theory. And presumably, there is some sort of duality that relates all these different descriptions and that eventually gives us the same string theory in this decoupling, well, in this limit of lambda going to zero. But of course, the problem is that we don't know how to control this limit, so it's hard to see that is really the case. So the main bottom line is that all these constructions give us confidence that this general picture, that there should be a QCD string theory for QCD, which is weakly coupled at large n. So of course, I should mention that, again, the string should have a coupling constant that goes like 1 over n, and that's what we find in these constructions, at least in the Klebanov-Strasser construction, where G string is constant. You can see that it goes like 1 over the rank of the Young-Mohs group. So this reinforces our belief that there should be such a string theory. And of course, the challenge, which can hopefully be met in the next few years, is to really understand how to take these limits or maybe start from some completely different place and see what this string theory really is that is dual to the Young-Mohs theory without all this additional junk that we have here. So hopefully one of you can find that solution. So thank you. Any more questions? Okay, good.
I guess you can't do it, right? So in this little string theory, you get rid of the scale because you switch to the same.
That's so right. Well, they're massive,
but they're not
massless.
Yeah, they are not massless. So can you twist supersymmetry here? Presumably also
probably it's Klebanov-Strasser?
On the S3. I don't think I can do it on a single.
Yeah, I'm not sure what that would mean.
Well, I still have, I will tell you all you need.